Deuteronomy chapter 31. Then Moses went and spoke these words to all Israel. And he said to them, I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also, the Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan. The Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord had said. And the Lord will do to them as he did to Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites in their land, which he destroyed them, when he destroyed them. The Lord will give them over to you, that you may do to them according to every commandment which I have commanded you. Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them. For the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him, in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. So Moses wrote this law and delivered it to the priests, the sons of Levi, who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, at the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women, and little ones, and the stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear and that they may learn to fear the Lord your God, and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God, as long as you live in the land which you crossed the Jordan to possess. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, the days approach when you must die. Call Joshua and the present yourselves in the tabernacle of meeting, that I may inaugurate him. So Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tabernacle of meeting. Now the Lord appeared at the tabernacle in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood above the door of the tabernacle. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land, where they go to be among them. They will forsake me and break my commandments, which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured. And many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in the day, have not these evils come upon us because of our God is not among us? And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they have done, in that they have turned to other gods. Now therefore write down this song for yourselves and teach it to the children of Israel. Put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness for me against the children of Israel, when I have brought them to the land flowing with milk and honey, of which I swore to their fathers, and they have eaten and filled themselves and grown fat. Then they will turn to other gods and serve them, and they will provoke me and break my covenant. Then it shall be, when many evils and troubles have come upon them, that this song will testify against them as a witness, for it will not be forgotten in the mouths of their descendants, for I know the inclination of their behavior today, even before I have brought them to the land which I swore to give them. Therefore Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the children of Israel. Then he inaugurated Joshua the son of Nun and said, be strong and of good courage, for you shall bring the children of Israel into the land which I swore to them, and I will be with you. So it was when Moses had completed writing these words of this law in a book when they were finished. And Moses commanded the Levites who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, Take this book of the law and put it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, your God, that it may be there as a witness against you. For I know your rebellion and your stiff neck. If today, while I am yet alive with you, you have been rebellious against the Lord, then how much more after my death? Gather to me all the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing, and call heaven and earth to witness against them. For I know that after my death you will become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. Then Moses spoke in the hearing of all this congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. Chapter 32. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb, and as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of truth and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. They have corrupted themselves, they are not his children, because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is he not your father who brought you? Has he not made you and established you? Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land, and in the wasteland a howling wilderness. He encircled him, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye, as the eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride in the heights of the earth, that he might eat the produce of the fields. He made him draw honey from the rock, and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle and milk of the flock, with fat of lamb and rams of the breed of Bashan and goats, with the choicest wheat, and you drank wine, the blood of the grapes. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat and you grew thick. You are covered with fat. Then he forsook God who made him and scornfully esteemed the rock of his salvation. They provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons, not to God. To gods they did not know. To new gods, new arrivals, that your fathers did not fear. Of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful, and you have forgotten the God who fathered you. And when the Lord saw it, he spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters, and he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faith. They have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols, but I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger, and shall burn to the lowest hell. It shall consume the earth with her increase, and shall set on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows upon them. They shall be wasted and with hunger, devoured by pestilence and bitter destruction. I will also send against them the teeth of beasts, with the poison of the serpents of the dust, the sword shall destroy outside. There shall be terror within, for the young man and virgin, the nursing child of the man of gray hair. I would have said, I will dash them in pieces. I will make the memory of them to cease from among men, had I not feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is high, and it is not the Lord who has done all this. For they are a nation void of counsel, nor is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. How could one chase 1,000 and put 10,000 to fight, unless their rock had sold them, and the Lord had surrendered them? For their rock is not like our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. For their vine is a vine of Sodom, and their fields of Gomorrah, and the grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter, the wine is poison of serpents, and the cruel venom of cobras. Is it not laid up in store with me, sealed up among my treasures? Vengeance is mine, and recompense. Their foot shall slip in due time, for the day of calamity is at hand, and the things to come hasten upon them. For the Lord will judge his people, and have compassion on his servants. And when he sees that their power is gone, and that there is no one remaining, bond or free, he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they sought refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices, and drank the drink of their offering? Let them rise up, help you, and be your refuge. Now see that I am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. Nor is there any who can deliver you from my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I wet my glittering sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to my enemies and repay those who hate me. I will make arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the heads of the leaders of the enemy. Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries. He will provide atonement for his land and his people. So Moses came with Joshua the son of Nun and spoke all these words in this song in the hearing of the people. Moses finished speaking all these words to Israel and said to them, set your hearts on all these words which I testify among you today, which you shall command your children to be careful to observe all the words of this law. For it is not a futile thing for you, because it is your life. And by this word you shall prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to possess. Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, go up to this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is the land of Moab, across from Jericho, view the land of Canaan, which I give to the children of Israel as a possession, and die on the mountain which you ascend, and be gathered to your people, just as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor, and was gathered to his people. Because you trespassed against me among the children of Israel, at the waters of Meribah, Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel, yet you shall see the land before you, though you shall not go there into the land which I am giving the children of Israel.
Thank you, Hank, for reading those two chapters. I know they're kind of long chapters. 32 is the longer one. 30 wasn't so bad. A lot of stuff going on here. And by the way, I did two chapters. I know it's an awful lot, but the primary reason is because I got a call early this afternoon that specified Jeff won't be here, so I'm going to extend our Torah study a little bit. Easier than trying to come up with something I'll do again with my own thing. So, as we begin, what did you guys learn from out of these two chapters? Anything catch that said, oh wow, I didn't know that, or yes, this now makes sense to me? Yes, Tammy.
I feel so sorry for Moses when I was reading this.
Yeah.
Think about it. I mean, you're 120 years old, you're on your deathbed, you have suffered through so much for so long for these people. And God tells you flat out, don't doubt that they're going to go after other gods.
Everything you worked for is really of minimal value, essentially. It's how we would take it.
In his time, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, they did it during his own lifetime in some respect, so it didn't take a whole lot for him to believe that statement. Yes, it is quite difficult. It's quite frustrating if I was in Moses' shoes, which we'll discuss that in a little more detail today, of placing ourselves in Moses' shoes and what's going to go through our minds and our thoughts. Yes, Hank.
Well, it brings up another interesting topic of predestination, in essence. How much God really knows.
How much he planned out.
How much is planned out, how much is free choice, and how much is God's will. He doesn't say if they
it's
depart.
When.
It's when. When. Mm-hmm. Which, is either, from the curse that, it's, we all have this the flesh tendency and, have that time. It just, but how he sets it up, a song to remember not to do this for a time, like how long they can last, hold their breath, singing this song before eventually everyone forgets it and, follows other gods.
Exactly.
Brings upon,
everything that the song says is going to happen.
Yeah.
It is a matter of time. Anything else anybody else learned or, yes, Tammy?
The other part of what I feel bad about for Moses is that to bring this upon him on his deathbed. I mean, imagine somebody, like, if you visit someone in the hospital, they're dying of cancer and this and that and the other. Normally, if you find out something, bad about their kid or, their grandson or something.
Keep your mouth shut.
You keep your mouth shut. Because they're dying of stage 4 terminal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing you're going to tell them is, oh, by the way, your grandson so-and-so is in jail right now, accused of murdering his wife.
Yeah, yeah. It's like some horrible thing that you don't do.
Some horrible thing, and mm-hmm. yet God dumps this all on him.
Yes, he does. A couple of times, actually. In previous chapters leading up to this, he reiterates over and over and over again. It's not an easy thing. Yes, Ellie.
See, I don't think so.
You don't think he tells him?
He does, but it's correction, like a parent. And when your kids have just been horrible, you say, fine, we're not going to go to the store, we go home. And the kid is devastated, and they're upset. And you let them scream and rant and rave and holler, and then pretty soon, after they've gotten their disaster, they're willing to talk. God has, he brings evil upon his children because he loves them, and he brings them back every generation, the same way as we do kids. There are times, anybody that had teenagers, there are times that you don't know if the kid's going to live through it, and you don't know if you're going to let the kid live through it. But they do, and they turn into people. And I think it's a matter of Moses' faith to say, this is going to be bad, Moses, but you know what? I win.
That's true. That is a good way of putting it. We're going to be discussing a bit more about Moses and his life, because we're ending it, we might as well just talk about what he's done throughout the rest of the next hour or so. Because we do project a little bit, which is our nature. We project our what is our thoughts? What are we going to be doing in a given situation? Which what we're going to be talking about today? Yes.
Since Ellie opened up the door to disagree, then
oh, of course,
I have to disagree that God brings evil, because the word says that God is not tempted with evil, neither does he tempt with evil. So he actually doesn't bring the evil. It's my understanding the chastisement of the Lord is the Lord stands back and says, okay, reap what you're sowing. I'm going to step back and let the enemy have his way. But God himself doesn't bring that evil.
Kind of like with Job.
Huh?
Kind of like with Job, in essence.
Yes. Her hand is raised.
Okay. Before we get into too much dialogue back and forth, this can spread into a much broader discussion because a lot of the Bible discusses this topic and discusses evil and discusses how its relationship is with God and how its relationship is with man, how he uses or doesn't use it in certain circumstances, as well as good and blessings. It talks about it in many, many stories. And so, so I don't want to go too far off topic here, but we'll give you one more rebuttal here.
Just in verse 27 of chapter 32, it says, he would have dashed him into pieces and made a memory of them to cease from men, had I not feared the enemy, saying, lest their adversary should misunderstand, saying, we did it. It's not God who did it. He's saying, don't anybody think that it wasn't me, because it was. All he has to, since the fall, all he has to do is take hands off when calamity happens.
He doesn't have to
bring the calamity.
That sure does.
That happens.
He's the only thing keeping it from coming upon him in the first place.
Only his covering saves us.
Yeah.
Anything else we learned from these two chapters? Before I continue on my little spiel here.
I did notice, and I think probably more because of our study through Joshua, but I do notice a lot, you know, that God, through Moses, is bolstering Joshua.
Yes, he is.
He's, you know, very much encouraging him to stand up with his sword.
And lift up.
Home.
Yep. It is a great transition point between Moses and Joshua. Unlike which modern day people, it's not necessarily 100% of people, but the vast majority of them, when they see their successor, there's a little bit of envy. There's a little anger that shows up inside of us. We see, well, this person's going to do what I couldn't do. And that is part of being a human being. If we didn't have that emotion, well, then God would have made us incomplete. Because he's envious at times. It's called no lifting gods before front of him. He gets envious. He gets jealous of that. We get the same issue. Same thing occurs to us. So this is a great transition point that shows Moses is saying or acting that, hey, Joshua, yes, you are going to do something which I would have loved to do. But God told me, no, I can't. And he does lift up Joshua. He does say, hey, this is what you're going to need to succeed. Which, of course, he repeats it. It's recorded again in the book, Joshua, the first couple of chapters there, of Moses' conversation with him. And it's important to note that, because Moses was the first judge of Israel, technically speaking, and Joshua was then the second. Though Joshua was called the first, because Moses was more of a master leader of all form, as well as religious leader up until Aaron took over. So it was a little bit more than just a judge, but it is a good transition point, and it's a great point that, yeah, he did raise him up. He lifted him up. That's not an easy thing to do for most people to do. I mean, take our modern politics. The incumbents don't necessarily care if it's people who just won the election. We run across that all the time. They get quite angry. Okay, so let's go back to Deuteronomy 31, first verse. Up to this point, it says Moses spoke and spoke these things to all of Israel, that I am 120 years old today. I'm not able to go out and come anymore. And the Lord said to me, you shall not cross this Jordan. At this point, put yourself in Israelite's shoes. What have you known your whole life?
Moses.
He's been your leader. He's been your parents' leader. You've known nothing else. There are a few exceptions. People in their late teens would have known life in Egypt. Only a little bit, though. Most of them were dead. So mostly, all you know is Moses. He is the elder of all form. He's going away. Very important, as Carrie mentioned earlier, it's very important that we note that Moses said, yeah, I'm leaving you, but there's something else for you to do. There's a future beyond this. Future beyond me. It's a good transition point. Again, we discussed this because we need that too. We need our own transitions. We are our own step from one leadership to the leadership. We need to feel like this is a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. So it's important that in front of all of Israel, not just the leaders. I'll point that out, that most of this, with the exception of a few points, he actually specifically calls only the leadership. All of Israel is present, at least, well, whoever can see and hear within a distance range is present. They see Moses addressing the people. They see Moses addressing Joshua and God dealing with him directly. Again, it helps the people to see, hey, this is not a bad thing. God's moving it over, and now we get to go have a little bit of fun with the Canaanites. Now Moses, of course, it says you did not cross this Jordan, which we read in the end of chapter 32. The reason was because he didn't glorify God at the rock. Moses' words when he struck that rock was not the act of striking the rock, is what he actually said. It was the statements he said. He didn't say, may God will bring forth water from this rock. He said, no, that I must bring forth water from this rock. It was a change of how you rebellious people, I have to do this for you. And that upset God. And the difficulty is that was in the last year of Moses' life. Imagine spending 80 of your 120 years of life, the vast majority of it, dedicating your whole life to God and trying to do what you could to please him. And at the last minute, you make a mistake. And everything you worked for is thrown away. The dreams that you've had are now gone. You wanted to enter that land. You wanted to lead the people, as you did all along for the past 40 years, but it was 80 years ever since when he killed the Egyptian. It was been 80 years at this point. You wanted to lead the people. You did the best you could. You weren't necessarily perfect, but you did the best you could. And then, the last minute, you make a mistake. It's gone. Who among us would that not devastate? To have worked the vast majority of your life, and then have it literally thrown out. Your goal, the one thing you've been desiring for, is now gone. But what did Moses do? Did it devastate him? Oh, I'm sure it probably did. But what would our actions be versus what Moses' actions were? And place yourself in the shoes. If everything you worked for is now gone, and God said, tough luck, you made a mistake, I don't care all the good stuff you did. The vast majority of people, and myself included, will say, God, forget you. This isn't worth it. The punishment's not fair. This is more than what I wanted. This is more than too difficult for me. However, what did Moses do? He accepted it and said, I'm still going to strive forward. I'm still going to work on your behalf. In spite of the one thing that I wanted, the one thing I dreamt for, you took away from me, I'm still going to do it anyway. Knowing full well that once he completed his task, he was a dead man. Once he completed, this is the last year of his life, once he completed the crushing of Og and crushing the king of Sidon, he was history. There wasn't going to be any life left for him. And yet he did it anyway. He pursued wholeheartedly and achieved the one goal, or at least a part of it that he could do, because he couldn't cross the Jordan. Difficult task for any of us to do. Great show of what his character was and what he developed to be. He wasn't that way years earlier, back 40 years prior, 40 years earlier, and then 80 years before that, or 40 years before that. That was not his character. He grew into it, but he still did it. Yes, Tammy, you had your hand up.
He spent that last year grooming his successor.
Yes, he did. Spent a whole year doing with Joshua.
He was preparing Joshua before this final speech or conversation. He was preparing him that whole time to
take over. So, Moses repeats this, I believe, once, twice. Moses says it twice, and then God says it once. Be strong and courageous. We discussed that back when we were discussing Joshua. Be strong and courageous with Moses' issue to him. As leader, these are the two things you're going to need the most. Strength and courage. Give me examples of why those would be important in Joshua and Moses' scenario. What does it mean to be strong? Just does he need physical strength?
Patience. Strength. You know, to be able to stand regardless of where the wind is blowing and what's coming at you, to stand and keep moving forward, even if you're pushing against the wind.
In Joshua, that's great. We'll stop with that for just a moment. We'll talk about that for a minute. In Joshua's life, when he was leading Israel, when did he need patience?
When didn't he?
How many times did he run across people that knew better and did the opposite? Well, let's see. The first time, once he entered the land, he ran across the first guy, actually a whole family who did that. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. They're dead now. That's probably why I don't remember the name. What was that?
Was that the family that...
took the goods from Jericho and shouldn't have, and they hid about it. And then, of course, that was the first week, I think, they entered in, or a week after, somewhere around that range. So that didn't take long for him to need that patience. And then, of course, what was the next item? Well, it's the battles and the wars. They fought, and people were dying now. Because up to this point, most of Israelites, after Jericho, most of Israelites didn't die in battle. They lost battles this year, but most of them didn't die. A small percentage did. They were nomadic. They did very, very well at God protecting them. Well, now he's dealing with people with death, dealing with losing battles, losing wars, preparing, have to deal with people who don't want to go to fight, have to deal with tribes that say, well, I don't want to go to that territory. I'm happy where I'm at. Patience. That is a great strength. I mean, another strength that he had to deal with, had to have, other than patience. Yes, Ellie.
One of the things Moses tells him is, he will go before you, he will be with you, he will not leave you or forsake you. Don't fear and be dismayed. That is a hard thing, to continue to have the faith that God is with you, he's going to guide you and going to lead you when everything can look really black.
That is true. It is a great faith to have. It is a great strength required. It does take strength, does take courage to have that. And Joshua periodically runs across, in his lifetime, but it happens more so after he dies, but during his lifetime, granted, he was only conquering Israel for less than a decade. So about 10 years before he died. So it was only the last 10 years we're dealing with his strength and courage needs and scenarios that he ran across. But let's back up just a little bit further to earlier in his life, when he was one of the spies. He was one of two that spoke out and said, no,
we can do this.
God's still with us. God will fight these people for us. Yeah, they're bigger, but he's still going to be with us. So he had faith. He knew God, who God was, he knew what he had, and knew what God could do for them. So, again, he needed to continue that strength, continue that faith in God, and he did. He was faithful. Did he make mistakes? Of course. Who didn't? Moses made mistakes. But he was still faithful. He had a great strength of that, of faith and belief in what God would do and what he was there for. Courage. Give me an example of courage that he had. Something that he needed to be courageous in.
Every battle he went into, outnumbered, outmatched. And it was the thing they went in with was the promise of God going before them and letting the enemies into them. Delivering the enemy into their hands if they did what he said. Sometimes they didn't.
Yes.
And then they would get wiped, and then he would have to go out again with the same people, trusting
what was left of them.
Yeah, you know, that they would kill everyone that they were supposed to kill, or not take goods, or do what he told them to do. It's like, you know, leading a team of people out to do something, give them the rules, going out, them not doing it, getting your butt hurt, regroup, and then having to go
do
out
it again
and trust that they're going to do it. You know, and then, you know, it's very, you have to be pretty well fortified and, you know, founded in God's promise and have courage and faith that God will,
he
do
will be there. He'll
this
do it.
Portion. You know, even though you may not be upholding, you know, doing the best to try to, you know, do what he has commanded you to do, your portion.
Give me, along those lines, what were some of the things that Joshua faced in those battles?
A big angel with a sword.
That was on his side, though, sort of, temporarily.
That's true. Yeah, you see a big guy with a sword drawn and you talk to him anyway.
Yeah. Well, and the one thing about the sword, the way it's written, how Joshua's life is written, is that angel seems to have taken out Jericho for him, but nothing else. It was more of Joshua and you're on your own.
This is how.
Sort of. It's been debatable whether or not the angel was necessarily involved in Joshua stopping the earth from spinning or rotating for a while, but that's a debate. Whether or not that was just straight Joshua talking to God directly as Moses did. We don't know. But, that's a faith point. What is one of the things that their enemies had that Joshua's men didn't? Chariots, a lot of chariots, a lot of iron chariots. No, they didn't have horses, though. They said horses, too. The Joshua's men have any of that. No, they didn't. So they're going against, it's a quote, infantrymen against an overwhelming force with chariots and horses. They're going to come against you. And in fortified cities.
Yeah, that's a huge portion.
Those are difficult odds. And what do you do? What did Joshua do? What are the examples that he had to do? He went out and met those enemies. He attacked first in most instances. He went out and fought first. He didn't wait. He didn't wait to defend himself, which is what the instinct is, defend your men so they don't lose too many of them as on the first onslaughts. He didn't. And in some cases, he went out there by himself, or with him, as himself, he wasn't like a general from the back, with his own tools, and went out there and fought and killed and did the best he could. At 110 years old, that's a hard thing to do. I don't know what his physical stature was, but I imagine was pretty decent, in pretty good shape. So he needed the strength, he needed the courage. What else did he need outside of military, outside of his physical battles that he had to do? They need strength and courage with. Well, some of the things, one is listed right here, some of these are listed to Joshua, but the one I want to focus on here is the inheriting of the land. See, Joshua had to deal with military issues, but just like Moses, he had to deal with political issues. Tribes saying, that's not what I want. I want to do X, Y, Z. I want this territory over there. How come I don't get my fair share? You have tribes that don't like each other by the end of Joshua's life. They have issues with one another. They're starting to dislike each other, starting to have their own, not wars, but political disagreements. Later turn into wars. But he has to deal with this as well, which does take strength and courage, doesn't it? Those are all the things that Joshua had. Well, not all, but those are many things that Joshua had to deal with strength and courage. One of the reasons why Moses told him, be strong and courageous. One of the reasons why God told him directly, be strong and courageous. This is not an easy task. Moses had a hard time doing it, and he was better than you. Bottom line, Moses was selected long before Joshua was. Moses did a great, fantastic job. Joshua did the best he could. But Moses had 40 years of teaching people, and working, and developing, and helping these people grow, and talking one-on-one with God. Joshua had the last 10, last 10 years of his life. Not a whole lot to work with. He did the best he could, which is a great thing that he had. One of the reasons why, the primary reason why Moses and God both told him, be strong and courageous. We're going to move past those first discussions here regarding this course. Moses was introduction when he started out in 31. It actually did a little bit in 30 as we discussed last week. But continue on. Verse 10. I like this verse. It's interesting. Not every synagogue, actually, because I've never heard of any synagogue doing this. Ever. Ever. I've never heard of it. As far as I know, it has never happened. Or if it did happen, it's never been recorded. But here it's recorded to do. Should it be done? Most likely, yes. Because God wanted it done. So verse 10, it says, Moses commanded, saying, at the end of 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of remission, on the festival of booths. Stop there for a second here. What's the 7 years, Mark? Do you recall what the deal is with every 7 years? Lord's rest year. What does that mean physically?
The land rests.
Land rests.
It's a release of debt.
That's on the 50th year. That's Jubilee year. Which is a seventh year, but it's not all the 7th years. It's just the one of them.
There are two forms of releases.
The Lord's release.
Yeah, one's going in the 50th year, but everything goes back to the original owner of the land.
Okay.
You can lease your land out for 50 years. At the end of 50 years, you must get it back. The family gets it back. Everything returns back to its normal heritage.
And it's rented or sold based on the number of years between now and the return year.
Right.
That's how properties. Now, but not necessarily debts. Some debts are, but not all debts. Debts in the form of slavery-based debts, those are released.
They're released. Right.
So if you own a slave that owes money, which is why you own that slave, well, thus the 7th year shows up. They are free. Their debt's paid off. It doesn't matter if they showed up to you in the 6th year.
Yeah, it's only been 6 months.
It could have been only 6 months. It could have been 3 days. The sabbatical year, the seventh year, is a fixed time slot.
Yeah.
That slave may owe you $100,000. So you own them for 3 days, and guess what? The seventh year shows up. Guess what? Three days, they're free. They owe you nothing.
You can't deny them.
You can't deny it based on that.
Because
it's the seventh year. Exactly. Specifically says you cannot wait. You cannot say, oh, well, I'll wait till after the year, then next year I'll confiscate you and everything you own for the next 6 years. It doesn't work that way. So that's, unlike that area, it is returned back. Money and debts, however, regarding to property are not. Property is waited every till the Jubilee year when it returns back. So there's some of them are returned debts, some are not. So why is it important to read this in the seventh year? Oh, by the way, first of all, what are we reading?
The Book of Deuteronomy.
Book of Deuteronomy. Is it the whole Torah?
No.
Book of Deuteronomy is read. And actually, not even the whole book. Technically, it's from chapter 3 to like the 28th chapter or something like that. It's not supposed to be the whole book. That whole section is supposed to be read. The only time that it was read was actually for Ezra's time. Maybe the one time it was actually read on time, on schedule, was Ezra did it. Hadn't been done before, hadn't been done after.
That
we know of. So I'll give him credit. At least once it may have occurred. But no other record of it occurring. It should be done. But it's not. So, not in the whole book, or not the whole Torah, but at least the Book of Deuteronomy is read. During the Feast of Booths, which you got 7 days plus one during that week, you got a whole week to read this book out loud to who?
The people.
The people. Which people?
All the people that are keeping the feast of tabernacles.
More than just that.
The stranger that lives with them.
It says, when all Israel comes to before the Lord your God, the place that he will choose, you shall read this instruction in front of all Israel in their ears. Assemble the people, the men and the women and the infants, your aliens, your gates, so they will listen and so they will learn and will fear the Lord your God. They'll be watchful to do all the words of this instruction. I'm going to stop there for a second here. Traditionally, that means, not saying the Bible specifically says so, but traditionally it means you will gather all the people of Israel. All the people of Israel, not just those few that showed up during that holy day on that particular year. Now, granted, the seventh year is a large one, but...
There's no I'm staying home.
Yeah, exactly. There is no I'm staying home issue. You're supposed to... Are you able to get full 100% of all the people to show up? Well, of course not. These are human beings. You're not going to get 100% to show up. They have farms and communities to take care of. They have slaves and servants to stay home to monitor things. But the point is, you get as many as you possibly can gathered together. That's what Rome used to do. Not for the Torah purposes, but for other reasons. And you can gather together as you can and read this amongst the women, the men, and the children included, and the stranger or poor. Person. Stranger and poor is used interchangeably in the Torah, by the way, in case you weren't aware of that. They're within your gates. How is that different from any holy day?
Well, the feast changes, you know, on the three-year pattern.
On a three-year pattern, it changes.
You know, the first one, they go to where the Lord has placed his name.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, they stay home and share it.
That's the third one.
Oh, that's the third one.
The first two do the same thing.
Okay, and then the third one, they stay home. And
it's distributed amongst their people in their communities.
Yeah. This one, everybody's going.
This one, everyone shows up.
Yeah.
Why is this different? Why did he have to say this particular one? Because in the Torah, it states who shows up on those first 2 years, as well as the fourth and fifth year. Mainly the men who showed up. Their families stayed home. Well, in this year, the seventh year, you have to gather the men and the women and the children and the poor strangers. They all hear the same thing. It's in order to get the message out to everybody. The goal is they all participate and understand the Torah, not just the standard few that normally show up.
Well, it seems the main purpose is that they understand and fear.
Fear the Lord your God and do what is written there. Do as it is required to do. God is not a God of men, or women, or children, or the poor strangers. God of all of them. Which is the point. Deuteronomy is a unique book amongst the Torah. It is not a Torah, not a book of just laws. Actually, very few laws written in there. There's a few, but not very many. The vast majority are in Leviticus and Exodus. Deuteronomy is a book of understanding.
It clarifies the positions. It clarifies the times.
Yeah, it does. It does. But it's designed to pull a little more at your heartstrings, a little bit more at your own emotions and what life is like.
It is advice.
It is. How do we do X, Y, Z rule? Exactly.
How you do it, just.
It is. Which is a great book to read when everybody's around to listen to it. Here's some advice. Take my advice. Yes, Hank.
It also makes sense for, to keep the law understood, because if the men are going twice a year, they're because of human nature, there are going to be people who could misinterpret things for their own benefit when they get back home.
Yes.
And on this year, everyone gets to hear the law, and that way, the head of the house is accountable to his family and his children and the strangers now for how he has dictated or educated them in what the law is. And
that's very true.
It will be self-evident to everyone.
It will be, and that's a great point to note, is that not everybody gets to know, or actually, the vast majority of people cannot read at this moment in time, and they don't read for a long time to come. Yeah, there are a few educated people, but the vast majority don't. You hire teachers. They're called Levites. You hire them to teach your children and teach your family how to read and leave with you, and that's what most people couldn't afford to do that. Unless you were a slave, in which your master had to do it for you. But that's exceptions. So, yeah, in this scenario, because everybody has to read it, everybody has to hear it at least, they all get a chance to understand. And that's how a slave or a servant or a spouse or a child knows when they're being treated properly or not being treated properly. If I go to a country who has a different religion than I do, and they tell me, well, their religion says I'm supposed to be treated X, Y, Z way, how do I know if they're lying to me or not?
How do people treat you?
Well, yeah, but do I know that they just didn't lie to me, that said, oh, well, actually, their religion says something totally different? I have to read the source. I have to study their own law. I have to figure out, all right, am I being treated fair? That's what other countries, citizens, when they come here, when they have to go through a court system or legal system, they got to read the laws. They have to understand what's going on. Every 7 years, it's guaranteed everybody will know it. Yes?
I'm sorry. I assumed your regular time schedule, we're going to have to get up and leave.
That's fine.
So I just didn't want you to think I didn't like it. You normally think about now.
Yes, we normally do. That's true.
I'm through over here anyway. It's been a pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
Yes.
Take care.
I just didn't want to get up and just...
I'll get there. Too soon, Jonda.
All right.
Take care. All right. Modern day tradition. What do they do instead of doing this tradition? Instead of doing this this rule, this law? What's their alternative? That may be, but instead of reading the law all at once on the Deuteronomy, what do? They distribute it, right? Either a full year cycle or every 3 year cycle, but it's just Deuteronomy? No, it's the entire books. Why isn't that good enough? Why doesn't that fulfill what God requests, what Moses tells them to do? Have any of you ever been to a synagogue that's on a 1 year cycle?
Oh, yeah.
How much is read? Yeah, it's about 2 inches worth of a paragraph. Yeah, how long would it take you to read and discuss 3 or 4 chapters?
Years.
It takes us hours, and we don't get through everything, do we? And we have to take one chapter at a time, usually. This is a 2-chapter thing I'm doing today. You miss an awful lot, don't you? If I flew through this, and the correct way of flying through this thing is actually I would have stopped at one chapter today, but that's just because of the way it's broken up. And then tomorrow I'll be going through three chapters, or next week, three chapters, back to back. And of course, the Torah section, or the Genesis section, you're covering a large amount of material, and you get to really discuss 10% maybe. Maybe 10%. You might get 15 on rare occasions, but it's usually 10. How much of the law and understanding and the character of God and Moses would you comprehend at the end of that day? 10%. About as much that was read. You don't really get it, do you? Well, the alternative, God said, all right, yeah, it's read. He knows the Torah is read every 1 year or 3 years. God's smarter than we are. He knows the story. He knows how it works. Probably one of the reasons why he said every 7 years, you're going to read it straight through in context, and everybody's got to hear it. Because the other thing you lose when you break it up week to week to week, as we do now, is how many of you remember what the Torah said, or what we discussed about the Torah, 4 weeks ago? Try 5 weeks. You know what? I'll make you a deal. How about the whole month of November? Does anybody remember what we discussed in the Torah the whole month of November? Well, of course not. Man, the foggiest idea we discussed in November. That was 2 months ago. Not that we don't know, not that we didn't discuss it. It's that when you read the whole thing back to back in huge context, you get a feel for something that you don't get when you break it up into small sections. I'm not advocating that we sit there in every Shabbat that we should all read the entire Torah. No. or that we won't read it except once every 7 years. That's not the point. The point is... Holy cow. Hire that guy to you. He's a speed talker. Yeah, to read the whole thing. No, that's not the point. The point is that the value is that you get everything in context. You get everything all at once and everybody gets to hear it. Let's continue on. Going to my notes a little bit here. What's the purpose of the Song of Moses, chapter 32? Why is it a song? Go ahead.
Oh, it's a song for memory's sake, because he knows they won't forget it if it's something they traditionally sing.
Exactly. Now, does anybody know the music lyrics to that? Of course, we all shake our hands. No, we've never heard the music lyrics to it. But we all know it's a song. We all know where it's at. And it sparks our memory. Oh, how many songs are in the Torah, by the way? Well, there's like two or three max, but most of them are really short. Like two or three line words. We actually have real songs to modern day songs that are to those words. Very few, if any of them, use any statement in the Song of Moses. Why? Yeah, it is. It's a depressing song. But it does.
It's a reminder.
It's designed to strike your memory. Exactly.
To understand why what's going on is going on.
Which is exactly. That is the reason why it's in song format. Now, whether or not we have a melody to it, that doesn't matter. It's still in song format.
Oh! We might be a few steps off here.
Yeah, just a little bit. See, I don't think we cover that one. I was going to discuss the various character traits of Moses, but it takes a little bit too long. Let's continue with chapter 32. This shouldn't take... Oh, yes, Ellie.
You know, when the resurrection happens and Moses is going to be teaching at the university and
he'll teach us the lyrics, I'm sure. And it teaches the melody.
The song, and we will all know the melody of the song. And because that is something that people have longed and wished and tried to understand for thousands of years.
Yeah, it's impossible to do by ourselves without knowing how it worked. It may have been multiple songs combined, who knows. Any questions about chapter 31 before I continue on 32?
No, 31.
Oh, what was your question, Tammy, or comment?
When Jeff and I were reading through chapter 32 and just reading the song, because in Revelation it tells us that, you know, in the Messianic era, that we'll be singing the Song of Moses
yes.
and the Lamb.
We'll have to know both songs. We'll have to know the melodies of them. Or close to it.
And I was thinking about this a little bit. You know, back to the whole, oh, this is a downer.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that.
Part of it is. Not the whole song, but part of it is downer. Yeah. Some of it's not.
So it's, you know, and you think that during the Messianic era, or even like towards the end of the Messianic era, when we're supposed to be happy that, you know, God is with us and this kind of thing. He's come to tabernacle with us for good and so on and so forth. And yet we're still having to remember
this history thing. Bad things that happened.
And all these bad things that happened and this kind of thing. Why wouldn't we just want to forget about those things now that, you know, all things that Yeshua said would happen have culminated? They're done.
Yeah, we just focus on the end.
We are done.
Yeah.
Why would we want to remember the song?
There's a great point, which is why the song is there, or one of the reasons why the song is there. Let's just go into 32 a little bit, because there's some interesting comments I want to say about it. Just a few, not a whole lot. He starts out, says, "Listen to the sky or heaven, however your wording says, so that I may speak. Let the earth hear what my mouth says." We'll stop there for a second. Why would he list these two as witnesses? This goes along a little bit along with what Tammy was saying. Because when the Messianic era shows up, depending on how your theological perspective is today, but when we're remembering these songs, how many of the people back here were alive then and will be there to read it or sing it along with us? Probably not a whole lot. There might be a few, but not likely a whole lot. Why? Because he's using heaven and earth as a witness, as it points out. You witness this because those two will survive from generation to generation to generation to generation to generation until it's over. Those two span the song and all time until the end. They're the witness. Now, what good of witness are they? If they can't talk, and does the sun or the heaven speak to you very often? If it does, you may want to see somebody about that. But normally they don't.
Well, you don't talk to the witness.
What was that?
You don't have to talk to be a witness.
You don't, exactly.
We have, like, Mount Zion as a witness.
Mm-hmm.
Noah's Ark is a witness.
Something that exists.
The stars in the sky, the sun, the moon are all witnesses of God's authority. Mm-hmm.
And
all the laws that hold everything in place and keep things in motion.
No, before I tell you, one of the things that witnesses normally have is tools at their disposal to help you. Oh, and there's a reason why in ketubahs and weddings we have best men and best women, or whatever you call it, maids of honor, whatever you call it, to stand up, because they're supposed to assist, right? Well, the earth and heaven have tools as well. If you don't do what God says, do you get rain? No. Heaven holds his witness against you. If you, and this is repeated previous few chapters, you will not get rain. Heaven is a witness. Oh, you're not doing what God said. I'm shutting itself up. You don't get me. What about the earth? What does the earth produce? Produce. They produce crops.
Fruits,
everything. Animals, the whole works. If you don't do what is proper and according to God in the land, what will the earth do? Produce zilch. Is a witness against you. It's two wonderful witnesses that Moses invoked here. Both of whom obey Joshua later on, but which is quite interesting. It says they both have the... Joshua stopped the sun. Joshua stopped the earth from rotating periodically for a short period of time and confined the moon in a certain area. Witnesses. Those are their tools. And that witness, by obeying Joshua, what did that witness mean? It means these tools are at your disposal when you need them. Through God's authority. Only for Josh, of course. I couldn't do that. I wouldn't presume that God would ever listen to me on those issues. But they're great witnesses with tools. They signify a point which permanence throughout all of mankind's history. So it hears and understands and knows the melody that Moses sang or gave. And also is going to know the melody that the Messiah gives. Because it saw and heard and read everything. and everything, all the lyrics it saw and understood. What day did the earth not hear or see something that God commanded was going to happen? Well, it heard and saw everything. Same with the heaven. They heard and saw everything. So he invokes those two as witnesses. Let my teaching come down like showers. Of course, again, they're tools. Let me emerge the thing which I do, like raindrops on plants, rainfall on herbs. When I call upon the Lord's name and avow our God's greatness, the rock, his work unblemished, for all his ways are just. A God of trust without injustice, he virtuous and right. He is not corrupted. His children are the ones that are flawed. What? Maybe let's read verse 5 again. Read it out loud. Let me see what verse 5 says.
They have acted corruptly towards him. They are not his children because of their defect, but are a perverse and crooked generation.
What are we, the devil?
Yeah, no kidding. Holy cow.
Perverse
and crooked. Yeah, it happens. It happens quite frequently, actually. It points out that is God the one, though he is just and perfect, is he one responsible for the bad things that happen? No, he's not. Is he? So quite plainly, he allows them to occur. He is completely independent of them occurring or not.
Simply because of their actions.
Simply because of them. And by the way, the term flawed is actually a term specifically used to discuss someone who is blemished for the priesthood alone. I mean, you have a physical defect to prevent you from being a priest. That's the pronounce it right. M-U with a little line over it with another M. I don't. I forget the little line. It's a moom or anyway.
Is it a straight line?
Yeah, straight line over it. It's, I pronounce moom, moom. Yeah.
It's
the straight and long. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, Hebrew word, not English word. Defect, priesthood defect. That you are unfit to serve God. That's what that word is. That's what it physically means. You are defective. That God set you aside, but my children or God's children, which you think, who was God's child? Well, the Messiah was. Was he defective? Well, not at all. But God's children who are defective, they are the ones who are defective. They are the ones who are unfit. They are the ones who are unworthy of the priesthood, unworthy of serving their God. Not that he is at fault, not that he is the problem, that they are the ones who are problems. But another question here. I happen to like that statement just a little bit for one other reason. Because when I read it, it brought to mind that whole, don't hold father guilty for the son. Because that's essentially what it's saying.
Yeah.
I'm God, but I'm not guilty for the things that my children have done.
Yeah, I like the way this says it. It says they have corrupted themselves. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. So it's like that's it.
Exactly. Everything else is fine, but that one feature is not for me. Yes, Ellie.
Well, even in verse 22, it says.
Oh yeah, it repeats it a couple times. Verse similar.
They've moved me to anger by their idols, and for a fire is kindled in my anger and will burn to the lowest part. It shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. Talk about the world being a witness. He burns it.
Yeah, he burns it, which is a permanent witness.
A permanent witness.
How many of you have seen fires? The scorching the land. It scorched it for a long time. Sometimes trees are wiped out, rocks are blackened. It's a witness. It shows up for a very long time. We're continuing on a little bit. In verse 8, on this song of Moses, when the highest, or the Messiah, or God, gave the nations territories or legacies, when he dispersed humankind, he set the people's borders to number the children of Israel. What does that mean? Verse 8, set the borders according to the number of the children of Israel. Well, children of Israel are millions and millions of people today. Are there millions and millions of countries with borders?
Yeah.
Well, not quite that many. There aren't that many. Yeah, there are thousands and thousands, but there aren't millions of countries and borders. Okay, so that can't be the reason. Well, maybe he's referring to the 12 sons of Israel, right? Are there 12 borders? Well, there's a whole lot more than just 12, though, are there? Throughout the whole world, there's a lot of borders. So that's not a good analogy. What exactly does he mean here? He set the borders of their nations according to the children of Israel, the numbers of the children of Israel.
This Jacob is the place of his inheritance.
Hmm. Right. That's Israel's inheritance is based upon the territory of Jacob, where he was at, and where God interacted with Jacob first time directly, which was Bethel. I take this two different ways. This is my perspective. You don't have to agree with me for any reason. You can think I'm full of it. Doesn't make a difference. I believe this way anyway. One is that he set aside the territory of Israel long before he set the borders of the world, of the nations. He broke it all up and said, all right, I need a space. I need a spot that's right at the worst place to live called Israel. And it is the worst place to live because at that time, guess where all the armies went through? Right through you. You are the whipping boy kind of thing of the whole world.
Cut and crust.
Exactly. Worst place to live. I set this side apart for Israel, for the children of Israel. Surrounded by desert. You got no resources whatsoever in this territory. There are a little bit, but not a whole lot.
No oil.
No oil. Yeah, they don't have any oil. Actually, I think the only oil they had was just before Sodom and Gomorrah. Because they had tar pits. And guess what happened to them? They're under the Dead Sea. Burned up most likely by now, or had been burned up and dissolved long ago. That's the only oil they had was taken away at that moment in time. And it points to tar pits, because during the military fights between Sodom and Gomorrah and the kings, they got caught in the tar, and I'm not going to go there right now, but it's a minor issue. They don't have any resources. That's one of my personal beliefs, that he set aside that spot, that territory, before the nations were broken apart. The other point of spec, which I also agree with, I haven't told them both. Yes, oh well, I do.
The creator is going to have his spots that he's going to create.
That he's going to set, he's going to select. He's going to select.
He'll let people remain there until he wants to, the landlord, until he wants to move his people.
Right to that spot. The other perspective, which I think is also equally true, is that he set the nations up for his children to flee to. Because he says, I will drive you out. And he drove them out a couple of times, actually. And where did they all flee to? Well, every other nation they could possibly find that would accept them. Every border around. Now, it wasn't set up such that there was one nation called Israel and then one nation called the rest of planet Earth. To where if you go across the border, you are in the same government, the same people, that if they don't like you, there's nowhere you to go. He didn't. He broke the rest of planet Earth up into chunks. Areas with different people, different beliefs. If one doesn't like you, there's another one that will. Different environments. That's another perspective, which I also hold them both. I think he probably, this is just strictly my opinion, that he set aside the nation of Israel, the territory, prior to setting aside for the rest of the nations. You don't have to agree with me on that. It doesn't make a difference. And the other is that he set all the nations and broke them up into chunks and sections and territories. They have a place to flee to. It's a place for his children to go when he drove them out. Now he goes through this story, through this song. It starts out, of course, initially praising God and distinguishing who he was. And it seems a little bit of one of the things he did. He ran across Jacob, which points out that was it verse 10, I believe it is, as I flip to that page. He found it. Now, my books, they use the word it. Most books use the word him or them. But they're all interchangeable because Hebrew doesn't use the...
It.
Yeah, well, it's just the way it's worded. Choice of words. He found it, referring to the people, in a wilderness land and a formless place, howling desert. He surrounded it. He attended to it. He guarded it like the pupil of his eye. As an eagle stirs its nest, hovers it over its young, spreads its wing and takes its legs up on its back. God alone let it and no foreign god with him, or led or protected it or walked it along its way. I think that's referring to Jacob. I think first Jacob because that's who Jacob was just before God intervened in his life. He was a formless man. No destination, was running through the desert, fleeing from his brother. And where was he headed to? The only place he thought he could live, Laban's house, or not Laban specifically, but that territory. And God went across him in Bethel. He made a deal. You protect me, you'll be my God. God protected him. God delivered him to a foreign country. Made him extremely successful. Delivered him right back to Esau, who would have probably killed him, with the exception of the struggle with Israel and Jacob, or Jacob and the angel, which we'll go back today. That's a whole Genesis thing, which is a huge, massive symbolism going on there. But struggles with Esau, or the God of Esau, or the angel, however you wish to look at it, and survives. God protected him, kept him completely safe. He continues on. First, continue on. To carrying over the eagle's wings, which is the same analogy used when God says, I will deliver my people back to Israel on eagle's wings. It's an analogy used quite frequently to deliver people, bring them out of wherever they're at. That, I think, specifically has to do with actually Egypt, pulling them out of Egypt. That's my personal belief. Going through the land of milk and honey, various of the stories going on. I'm not going to read all of this because it refers to some of this in 13 and 14. What I want to stop on is verse 15. Somebody read verse 15 for me. What does your verse 15 specifically say? Anybody?
But Yeshurun grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation.
Okay. Does anybody else have something else other than says Yeshurun? Does anybody know what Yeshurun means? Is that a person? No.
It says it means the right ones.
Yeah, the righteous ones. People who are right. People who are doing good. That's what it's referring to. Yeshurun is just nothing more than says a person who is a righteous individual.
It goes right back to the previous chapter, verse 20. When I have brought them to the land flowing with milk and honey, of which I swore to their fathers, and they have eaten and filled themselves and grown
exactly.
fat,
exactly.
then they will turn to other gods and serve them, and they will provoke me and break my covenant.
Exactly. And he's just in the song and actually uses essentially that same phrase or similar phrase that was it? Don't forget, you're going to do this. You will be prosperous. It's the second one is in source. Yeah, it's a permanent one that continues on through all time. You will be prosperous. Things will be great for you. You'll have wonderful food. You'll be happy and content. And you'll forget that I ever existed. Yeah, you won't care about me anymore. You'll turn to the gods. And why I wanted to stop there is that it's not referring to people who are already bad, people who are already evil, people who already believed into the gods, was it? It's referring to those who are righteous, who know who God is. They're going to let go. They're the ones who are going to say, you know what? I'm good. I'm happy. God, leave me alone. That's difficult for God to feel, for God to see. The ones he blessed, because that they were righteous, he blessed them. And then because they're blessed, they now reject him and become unrighteous. In that scenario, what incentive does God have to bless a righteous person? Not a whole lot. Better off keep them struggling till they stay righteous their whole lives than bless them at the end and then they all fall apart. There's not a whole lot of incentive. Not to say he doesn't bless the righteous, I'm not saying that. But the point is that it's actually more beneficial for us as people to not be overwhelmingly blessed. To not be wonderful and happy and content and nothing go wrong with our lives. Why? Because who's God again? Will go right through us. Yes.
It's like it's worth taking the flack from all the other parents of not buying your kids anything and making them look like a bunch of street urchins, you know, so that they still know who their parents are.
That's true.
And then actually go out and buy them that thing. It's like, well, you don't need a parent. You got all your toys.
You have everything you need. Exactly. Yep. It is true.
We see it in the home meeting.
Yes, we do. And it's funny. And that's, well, our parents take care of that. Yeah, we could buy you all these things. We're not going to, specifically so that you know that we are your parent. We're the ones in charge, not you. I like that statement, though, because it points at the righteous in particular. You have a question in your head.
There's a psalm. I think it's in Psalms. It may be Proverbs, but I think it's in Psalms. It says, that David says, let me not be so poor, no, so rich that I forget you, nor so poor that I curse you.
Yeah. There is a line you gotta walk. Yeah. I don't think it's a psalm, but he's right. It is a Proverbs. Yeah, that's true, and that's one that God is always careful of. He doesn't seem to curse the righteous, with the primary and so as far as I know, only exception of Job. But that's a whole other story. We're not going there yet. It's a long time from now. But, yeah, the righteous doesn't bring them down to their, they are poverty-stricken and miserable and hate him. That doesn't achieve God's goal either. There's just a certain level of just happiness. Just the right amount of difficult struggle and blessings. Yes, Ellie, continue on here.
It can be a curse both ways. You can be so poor that you give up, or so rich that you quit. Both ends of it.
Yes, which is what his whole point. That he's pointing out here in this chapter, the previous one, and actually one before that as well, that they become so rich or so affluent, so happy and so blessed that they don't bother. There is no God as far as they're concerned anymore. Now, I'm not going to go through every little verse here because it takes forever. I want to point out that one of God's concerns, which I don't know if you've picked this up or not, but you soon will if we keep reading the Genesis and Moses' interaction with him, is how God appears to others. He brings that up a couple of times. God doesn't like people who don't worship him to think that he is bad. He doesn't. Moses brings it up to him a couple of times. When he's about to destroy Israel, he says, wait a minute, God, if you destroy it, what's everybody else going to think of you? And God says, okay, yeah, you're right. I won't destroy it. I'll just punish them instead, but I won't kill them all.
I'm surprised that you can live through.
Good point. Maybe they'd be better off had he destroyed them. The point is that he doesn't like how he looks to others. Now, we would think, oh, who cares what the rest of the world thinks? Well, actually, it appears, according to the Bible, according to the consistency of the Torah, God cares. God cares what everybody thinks of him, as well as what people think of you. Because you're his children, too. He cares about that. See, it does matter. It does matter what the world thinks. It does matter what they say and how they handle themselves and how they perceive him. He doesn't want himself to look bad. He's a little bit of pride there. Make yourself look weak. He likes the praise. I like that comment because throughout this book, chapter, actually throughout the whole Torah, but this chapter in particular, he points out that he can bring up Israel's enemies. I mean, all the way through with it, 28 and 31 in particular, those few verses, that he talks about Israel's enemies and that they would attribute Israel's defeat to how great they are, how great their God is, and how worthless Israel's God is. He says, wait a minute, I'm going to stop once you reach that point. Once you've reached there, I'm going to turn the tables around to where those enemies are not the ones saying how great their God is. They're not saying, holy cow, flee from the God of Israel. He likes to look good too. Now, he doesn't quite wipe out all of Israel through this process. He goes back and re-explains them. He explained it like three times now, four times now in the last couple of chapters, to Israel that they're the ones who are deserving of this. Yes, Hank, you had your hand up. Sorry.
I would. I'm sure you don't agree that it's just that he wants to look good.
Oh, it's not just it looks good. Right,
no,
right.
It's the whole concept of these are his children on the other side to of which he loves, of which he wants.
The goal is to get them to turn to him.
Yeah, he's not just trying to. He's not just focused on Israel, is essentially what he's portraying.
Right.
He's focused on everyone. He has a promise, a covenant with Israel, which he will maintain and be their God. But, you know, like, we are in the time right now experiencing his love of the other people, too, mm-hmm. and wanting to bring them into his ways.
Exactly. And that's one of the key points about how you appear. What incentive is it for, let's say, the Egyptians to go worship the God of Israel? If they think he's a mean brute that just killed all those people off.
Or if they think that he doesn't exist.
Or if they think he doesn't exist.
You know, okay, fine, the Israelites got together and they beat us one time.
Yeah, we can take him out now.
You know,
or if he thinks it's a group of people that drank poisonous Kool-Aid.
Yeah, exactly. The incentive, yeah, is, I didn't mean to say that it was strictly because of, well, it did sound that way though, that I had worded it that way. Is that it wasn't just God just appeared, said only about what he looks like. The object, the goal of when you do maintain a good appearance is that the other people around you notice. They see it, right?
It's called light.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, the light that you produce as well as from God.
What do they think I am? And the apostle said, well, some think you're the prophet, some think you're Elijah, some think, and he turned to them, he said, who do you think I am? And he said, well, you're the Son of the Living God. So it does matter.
Yeah, it does.
Right, but what
he wants to know what they thought of him.
Yeah.
It does matter.
It does matter.
I mean, we're having a nut in a long line of nuts.
Yeah, well, some may argue that. So, okay, in verse 30, well, I'm not going to read through all this because I want to finish this off. I've got two more points I want to talk about today, and I'm hoping to get them done. I know I'm taking a little bit longer, but that's because we're not having a second session. So I hope you bear with me. Somebody had their hand up a second. Who was it? Was it Richard? You had your hand up a second?
I forgot.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. We all do that. Okay, so he goes back and explains to Israel in this own song they're supposed to remember, 32 and 33, 34, that it's your fault. Anyway, make sure you understand where the blame goes. You guys are the ones doing it. I'm just allowing it to happen because of your own existence. But at the end of it, which I love this part, and which is the whole point, I believe, what Tammy started out with, as to why we're going to be singing the song again, is the end. That God says, no matter what, those ties of Israel, to the people, will never be broken. I will bring you back. I will revisit your enemies significantly worse than they gave to you. That the promise they gave will never go away. And that's one of the things we praise him for. That the promise didn't go away. It hasn't gone away. Yes, Hank.
Well, I was in a small point, but I'm not like that. That is what's come under attack between Christian and Jew. That has been the deception is... There has been a lie circulated in the Christian circles that God has abandoned the Jews. He has given up on them, and now they are his new chosen people.
I'm going to rephrase your word there. That God has hidden his face.
Yes.
Those are the words that God uses throughout both these two chapters. God hid his face from them.
Yeah. I'm not saying he has abandoned
them. No. I know. But I'm purposefully changing it. You're right. It does appear that we abandoned it. They use the phrase all the time. But God said specifically... I'm actually hiding my face from you.
For a while.
Is God's face currently hidden from us? Yes, it is.
Because he wants to see what we'll do.
Well, yeah.
That's a logical thing. It's just like, you know, you let your kids go to see what they're going to do. You let them grow up. I wonder how they live their life.
Yeah.
And you're waiting. You want to choose the right one. And you say, well, I'm not gonna look at them. I'm gonna go over here, and I'll come back later to see how they're doing.
One other thing he's after, you're right, that's what a standard rearing of child is. A bunch of all people have to do that, whether you want to or not, and who have children, that is. One other thing that God specifically was referring to that I want to talk about here he mentions it twice in chapter 31, but 31 verses 17 and 18, and 31 verse 32 verse 20, he will hide his face. Let's talk about that for a minute. What does it mean to God when he says, hiding my face? Well, let's go back to his history for a moment. The first day of creation, was God's face hidden? No, it was actually quite evident. Anything that could see would see his face, would see his actions, would see what he was doing. Or the second day, was his face hidden of creation? No, not at all. You could still see him producing things. You could attribute direct items to his interaction. Throughout all of creation, God never hid his face. With Adam and Eve, seventh day, he rested. That's true. But with Adam and Eve, did he hide his face from them?
Well,
no.
They hid from him,
but he didn't hide his face from them. All right? He hasn't hidden his face through creation. Let's continue on a little further along with the flood. Was God hiding his face during the flood? Well, of course not. If he hid his face, there wouldn't have been a flood. Hiding God's face doesn't mean you can't see it. It means there's no evidence that he has done something or is doing something or has done anything or will do anything. Hiding one's face, you can't see it. You can't see him anymore. All right? Witness of him. So let's continue on a little further along in that story. After the flood. With Abraham. Did God hide his face from Abraham? Well, of course not. I talked to him all the time. Well, as an older man. He talked to him a lot, actually. With Moses. Was God hiding his face from Moses? Well, no. He wasn't. Moses was the first person I got to see most of him. It was kind of interesting. But he didn't hide. He was interacting with Moses a lot. All of Egypt. All those plagues. Well, yeah, obviously they're from God. These don't naturally occur. I wouldn't hope they do.
Oh,
so yeah, splitting the Red Sea. No, obviously his face wasn't hidden.
Man, exactly.
The quail, the shoes that never wore out. Was his face ever hidden? No, you could see his physical interaction all the time. Throughout Moses' life and Joshua's life, did he hide his face? For the most part, no. Yeah, there's sometimes you kind of question, well, where is he? Because they lost the battle, but then it was their own fault, so they deserved it. The judges, did he hide his face? No. When did he point out? He pointed out, one chased 1,000? Two, 10,000? The battles we discussed with Deborah and Barak, those were impossible odds. Not unlikely, impossible odds.
Samson's
a great point. Did he hide his face with Samson? No, human strength can't do that. It's not possible. However, he did.
We got a king.
From Samuel on, did God hide his face?
Yeah,
he did. What interaction, he did it even more so later on. What interaction did the people have then at that point?
The temple.
The temple, they had prophets that could still do miracles. But you didn't see God. What was that?
It was their relationship with God.
With God, yeah.
God's relationship with God.
Exactly. The only evidence they could physically see with their eyes was the cloud that was left above the temple. That's the last evidence they had that they could see that there is a God. He didn't move. Never went anywhere. But there's a cloud over this temple. Through Solomon's time, he was a king, but he still had those clouds still there. He actually completely hid his face at what moment in time?
Babylon?
The expulsion, exactly. The diaspora. You never saw God's face again. Once they came back, you never saw God's face again. Well, yeah, but Yeshua, you don't actually, you see it, but that's a different scenario. Something else happened at that moment. Today, when I asked earlier, do you see God's face?
All faith now.
It's strictly faith. Can you point to something and say, oh, see, there's God, or that's what he just did? Can you point to anything out there and say, oh, yeah, that's what God did? It's quite obvious, because everybody sees it. Not just you, but everybody sees it. Oh, yes, obviously that's God.
Creation, I mean,
what do you point to?
The evidence of.
You see
that's the history of it. But there is no saying, oh yeah, that's God. See, he's actually, you see the cloud that's moving, he's going over there, and now he's going over here. Oh look, hey, they split the Red Sea. You get, exactly. You're hiding his face means you can no longer see him, and as far as you're concerned, you're on your own. It is strictly by faith that you believe. That's to hide his face. He says, I will hide my face from them. It takes time. He hid it in sections. Early on, he talked to his prophets and talked to his people with the creation. Yeah, he was right there. Any angel could see it face to face. Eventually, he hid it completely, and there was nothing left. You didn't see him. You still don't see him.
With a promise of.
A promise that he'll return. A promise that he'll still be there. But you have the faith. That's the last bit. It's strictly your faith. That's hiding God's face. He hid it. It's still hidden. We don't see it yet. We will, but we don't see it yet. Yes?
We tend to do better when we have to come find him than when...
Our own hearts will turn stronger and actually be more dedicated to him.
Like your own children. They, when you're there, when they come to you... rather than you chase them. It's very annoying to be a grown child and have your parent chasing
you.
It's almost like raising a child to a point, placing him in the woods with provisions, leaving and letting him find his way back to you. It's not till he does that is he grateful.
You mean John F. Adams? Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they grew up in a cushy, soft house with indoor plumbing.
They don't
know otherwise. Yes.
We're going to Alaska.
All right. Well, I'm going to call it quits here pretty soon here. After this one last moment. Moses receives his last instruction. Well, he received it, but the book doesn't technically end because he does a few other things which... it's argued he actually did them earlier, but they're recording it at the end of the book for other reasons. This is his last personal instruction from God in the end of the chapter. From 44 on, essentially, for all practical purposes. Actually, 48, more accurately. You shall not enter the land, but only see it. And Moses recites the reason why he reiterates it again and again and again throughout most of Deuteronomy. It's because he did not glorify God at that one moment in time. We're going to discuss all the characters and how that influenced him through that last year. I wanted to, but it takes forever. So we're not going to go that today. But you shall not enter the land. Where did he get to see it from? Mount Nebo. I don't know if you recall remotely about what we discussed about with Gideon. I know it's been a while ago. He attacked the Midianites from Mount Nebo, and Mount Nebo is on the other side of the Jordan, just a short distance south of middle of the Dead Sea, off to the far east. So he got to go to the mountain and see, literally over the Dead Sea, which actually looks quite nice from high up. It's actually very attractive-looking water, because all the salt that's in it, and some funny things are going on. Anyway, and see over the mountain range, and it's just high enough. It's been argued you might be able to see the Mediterranean Sea from that moment, from that spot, if you look right. But I haven't been there, so I can't swear that that's the case.
Oh, no smog.
Yeah, no smog. Yeah. You probably could see pretty clear.
And it's also springtime, so.
Yeah, that's true. It's springtime.
No Hamas
rockets. Yeah, no Palestinian issues and burning tires. Go up to meet Mount Nebo, 120 years old, and God takes him. Doesn't get the one promise he worked for 80 years. But he still did it anyway. It's a great character that we can all take with us to focus on. Our own personal goals, what we want, are by strict definition secondary. Moses wanted to be able to go to carry them through the Jordan. And he, for 80 years, from the killing of the Egyptian guard all the way to this point, he did as best he could to follow everything that God told him to do. And he would have done it, except the last year. Actually, a few months prior to this moment he's addressing them. He forgets and misstates something that he shouldn't have done. He should have been more careful when it comes to doing a miracle in the name of God. You have to cite that it's in the name of God. And he didn't. Thus, He loses it. But it didn't stop him. That's the key. It didn't stop him. He didn't say, oh, I give up. I worked all this for so long and I got nothing at the end. I give up. He didn't. He knew when he completed his task, he would be dead. That's the end of it. But it didn't slow him down. He didn't say, well, let's drag our heels a little bit before we conquer off Og and Sigon, or whoever. I can't pronounce it properly. Sigon, I think it's pronounced. He didn't. He fought anyway. He completed the task in spite of the fact that it was going to kill him. Wonderful character trait that we all can take with us. Any questions we have? I'm going to go ahead and call it quits for chapter 31 and 32 of Deuteronomy. Well, I thank you for your time.
Thank you.